Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Russell Tovey and
Robert Diamant.
And we're here with Talkart. And we've got a special Talkart episode this week because we have teamed up with another podcast who we greatly admire and have admired for a long time called Homo Sapiens.
It's a podcast collaboration, crossover.
Exactamundo.
What other words can we use? Incredibly creative.
It's connecting us to different audiences and experiences and authenticity. And we are very proud of this. So please listen to this episode. And when you're finished, pop over to Homo Sapiens and listen to their side of this same story.
Yeah, because this is in two parts. Part one is on the Talkart feed, and then part two is on the Homo Sapiens feed. And you can find them just by searching Homo Sapiens, all one word, on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talkart.
Welcome to Talkart.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling glad to be gay, which is a reference to a Tom Robinson song, who was actually a real champion of mine when I was about 20 or something, when I made music. But I'm actually gay to be gay today, and also gay to be queer, and super gay, basically.
No, that's not like you.
You're right.
Who is Tom Robinson then? Tell us who Tom Robinson is. No relation to Tony Robinson, is he?
Google it. The fact you're even asking that question is like offensive to me. So today is not a normal episode of Talkart. It is actually Talkart versus Homo Sapiens, which is an awesome podcast about LGBTQ plus human rights issues. And I've been listening for a long time. It was originally with the singer Will Young, and I used to listen every week, and there was actually an amazing episode where they went to America and met an Uber taxi driver, which kind of broke my heart. I loved that episode so much. And now they have evolved, Homo Sapiens, and Will has gone back to his music career for a while, and I think he's written a book as well. And the new co-host is the one and only actor Alan Cumings. Love. Sorry, Alan Cumming. I just did it plural. I don't know why.
Thank you.
But I did. It's because you've got so much personality that you're now plural.
Yeah. Just keep coming. Yeah.
Yeah. So we are excited to have this special joint episode, which will go out on both of our platforms, part one and part two. And we're going to be talking all about art and creativity and just being gay and all of our experiences growing up, I think. So, yeah, we would like to welcome to talk up with Homo Sapiens,
Alan Cumming and Chris Sweeney.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hello, people.
Hi.
I'm in shock that you don't know who Tom Robinson was, Russell Tovey.
No, I know, I'm terrible. I've just looked him up and I've just seen he's the radio presenter and everything.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way.
I didn't know either.
Hey,
I Googled.
Shut up. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Oh my God. I feel ancient, talking to hag. How old are you, Rob?
I was born in 1980. I think, when were you born, Russ? 81.
Oh, for fuck's
81.
Sake.
Yeah, just missed it.
When were you
but
born,
I'm obviously
Christopher?
Just a bit more cultured than Russ.
82 is my official age. Born 1982. Stage age.
I was born in 1965, ladies and gentlemen.
No.
Thank you very much. Drop the mic. Yes.
So do you actually remember then when Glad to Be Gay came out?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember. Like Tom Robinson was like a person on Top of the Pops. And yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
He was like a pop star. It's interesting about Tom Robinson. Didn't he kind of go back in the closet? I mean, like, sort of stopped being gay.
Later. Well, I think he fell in love with a woman, yeah. And I think he's
That's
bisexual.
What I mean, yes.
And maybe she is too. I'm not sure what the story was. I remember him telling me years ago, because I met him when he was at BBC Radio 6, which I think he probably still is there. I haven't been listening lately. But and I think he said that he was married to a woman, but they were kind of bisexual, but they fell in love with each other. And I think it was one of those situations where you fall in love with the person, not the, you know, the, yes. the gender.
The genitals, yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
Not the genitals, yes. But oh my god.
So where are you in the, where are you guys in the world? Whereabouts are you? Where are we finding everyone? I'm in London.
I'm in Hackney, London as well.
Very nice, very nice.
And
Alan?
I am in the Catskill Mountains of New York State.
Oh my god. Have you been there the whole time in lockdown?
Yes, cuz I was in London doing a play at the Old Vic, and that's when it all went to shit. And then I went back to Scotland for a couple of days and flew back and went straight from the airport. I dropped my bags off at our place in New York City. And I think I've been here since March the 19th. It's been magical, actually, to be... This is like my country house, and I'm here for weekends and blah, blah. But to have been here... I mean, it was snowing when I first got here. And to be here over all the seasons changing, and to be in a place where I feel completely safe, has been
amazing. That's so important. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was in New York, and then the show got cancelled. I was doing a play on Broadway, and then I flew back, and then I've just been at home in East London.
Right. Of course.
Yeah, crazy days. So you guys have listened to Talk Up. We've obviously listened to your show, and we're all on board. But have you listened to Talk Art? And are you confident to talk about art?
Yes.
And if we brush up on our queer art history?
Yes.
Absolutely. We're big fans of Talk Art. And what I love about Talk Art is that it's about taking away some of the sort of mystery around art, and that it can be a bit excluding of people, which I think is so cool, because so much of it is made out to be like this kind of dark magic, you know, and it's not. Mm. And I love the way you've demystified it.
Thanks, Christopher.
I concur.
I also feel a bit of a parallel between our podcasts, because I feel like both of them kind of, you know, like you have the kind of main theme of the show, say, but I think it ends up becoming something quite celebratory about the guest, and also a bit like therapy or something.
It is very like therapy,
yes,
isn't it, Alan?
Indeed.
Whose phone's
gets ringing? Very therapeutic.
It's not mine.
I'm so sorry. I've just realized it's mine. Oh my God. So here's the thing. There is a bowl sitting next to me full of rice. In it is my mobile phone, because I dropped it in the hot tub last night. And because of that, I've had to use the landline, which seriously, I haven't used in years. And I think we only have it in case of nuclear attack. And and my dog's upstairs going nuts.
So does this mean nuclear attack?
No, it's just that my phone's broken. I had to give the number. I had to let my assistant call. I think it's my assistant calling me about things about this. But our dogs are going nuts because they haven't heard the phone.
Yeah.
So that was mine. That's a quaint little Catskill phone for you there. Sorry about that.
It sounded so British.
I actually loved it. I was going to say it reminded me of 80s Britain for some reason. Sounds very
old school. Too.
Do you remember that thing they used to have when you'd call? Are you all too young to remember this? But when you'd call and it was engaged, and they go, "The number you're calling knows you are waiting."
Oh yeah, I love that.
Yes, me too.
I love that lady.
Talking about the 80s though, when you were younger, were either of you creative? Well, not the 80s for Alan, but 70s.
Alan, don't take
70s
that.
For Alan. God. Take that as a compliment.
Oh, my God.
No, 70s were cooler than the 80s.
Nightmare. Right? Yeah. Well, yes, I think I am creative. I think we're all creative. Little tight. Do you mean like were we arty, making art creative? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Or how, I'm just interested in like what it was like when you were growing up, and like how you ended up becoming what you
did. Well, way back then, it was like, you know, we had pots of paint were delivered on horseback and we used to like go and kill the animals to make our brushes. But no, I mean, I grew up in Scotland, and we had great, I mean, you know, it's interesting sort of living in America now, and also looking back at Britain and the way that the education system is going, and realizing, you know, we had great art was a big part of our schooling, and it was deemed very important, and it still is in Scotland. I think the arts are deemed much more important in Scotland than they are in the rest of Britain, and certainly than they are in America. But now when I look back at it, I take photographs. I had an exhibition of photographs a couple of years ago, and I'm married to an illustrator, so I kind of like I have a lot of creativity in that area around me. But I actually really love the room I'm in right now in our house. It's called the Arts and Crafts Room, because it's a big sort of sideboard over there, and it's full of like things on rainy days, and we come and make collages. I love a bit of decoupaging. And yes, I always say décolletage, but that means boobs. But I do love that. I do love a bit of décolletage. Yeah.
Your chest, sweaty, chesty area. What did you say? The collaging you do. So, like, what's in there then? Like glitter and
glitter, glue,
crepe paper,
old interesting pictures, crepe paper, paints, pens. You know, little bubbly things, sort of all different crafty stuff, and boxes. All like if you get a nice present in a posh box, I keep the posh box for decoupaging, and that's what I like to do. Like I'd for presents for Grant, actually for his birthday, because it was when we were in lockdown, I made him like a little box and put old pictures, old photographs and things inside of our old dogs and everything like that. And colour it and put glitter and stuff on it. I like that. It's a nice sort of thing to do.
Yeah, it's great.
And then you get all these boxes and you don't know what to do with them. But it's a lovely sort of thing it's enjoyable. And we also do some papier-mâché. There's a few things with old, coat hangers and old bits of old newspaper. I love a bit of that. Actually, guess what? A few years ago, I made a papier-mâché hat, right? Here in this very room. I was very proud of it. It had a little sort of a little peak. It was like a little berry with a little peak, but it was made of paper, newspaper, and it had, all covered in glue and it was made of coat hangers. And I wore it to a party that Lady Gaga gave for the launch of some collection of things that she was selling. And I wore it on the red carpet at a big event. A papier-mâché hat. I should find a picture of it and send it to you. It's hilarious.
Talking of pop music, I saw you on the on Madonna's Instagram because she invited you to the show in London, though. How are you friends with Madonna?
Oh, that's a long story. I first met her. I know it is actually. I met her. She came to see Cabaret when I did it on Broadway the first time in 1998, and afterwards, we were all like, "Oh, Madonna's in," and I could see her in the audience. And I was sort of always on stage, sort of lurking, sort of seductively somewhere, lying around, and I saw her braiding her hair while she was watching the show. And then so afterwards we were all thinking, is she going to come backstage? She didn't come backstage, and I thought, oh, she hated it. Oh dear, how awful. Then I went and had a shower. And when I came back into my shower, after my shower, I was drying myself. And this big man came into my room and went, "Hi, Alan. I'm Madonna's driver. I'm Kane." And I went, "And I'm Abel." he then said, "Madonna wants you to come with her, come with me and go for dinner with her." And I was like, "Okay, I'll see you outside." And then, of course, I went upstairs. I was like, "Oh my God, oh, Madonna's invited me to dinner." Oh my God. And then I got in the car with them and I thought, he could be a total imposter. He could be like a murderer. And I've just got in the car with this person. He says he's Madonna's driver, but, I could be being taken to my death right now.
Oh my
God. Instead, I was taken to Nobu. And that's how our relationship began. Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. But when I did that thing, the thing you saw on her Instagram, it was actually, when she was doing her concerts at the Royal Albert Hall, I got free tickets to go to it. And what I had to do was to do this thing where she pretends to go, "Oh, hello." I'll just sit down beside this member of the audience. And it's usually a famous person and she has a little chat with you. But during that chat, it was nice to see her. She talked about coming to see me in Cabaret, and I said, "I remember you were braiding your hair." And she went, "Was I? That's incredibly rude." And I went, "Yes, it was rude." Like that. It was kind of nice to go back to it after all these years.
Oh.
Are you Madonna fans?
Yeah, well, I just did an interview for Griefcast, another podcast, the other day, and I was talking about how Blonde Ambition had been such a kind of important moment for me because, A, I kind of related to the immaturity of it all because I think everybody in it was acting like they were about 11 years old, which I was at the time. And B, I just think it was such an important positive message for kind of inclusivity and diversity and sort of gay rights. And I think I saw myself for the first time at that age of 11, and it kind of gave me permission to then could sort of be myself. And I found it quite interesting, just the idea that, that when you're growing up, you can kind of align yourself with these figures in pop culture or, whatever it may be. And Christopher and I the other day were talking about David Hockney as well. Because the idea that even artworks and artists can also give you that kind of permission.
There was this sort of, I remember Hockney being this weird Trojan horse of, like it was in the books at school, and it was two men in a shower and you're like, holy fuck, how did this get in here? But it was like, I remember it being my first memories of like queerness and from a young age and seeing that. And no one, normally those images were kind of vilified as wrong, but they weren't because they were art. And I always thought that was quite interesting that they were just accepted and praised, you know?
Yeah.
Which I thought, but it was interesting what you were saying, Alan, about like Scotland appreciating art and the arts, because in London, where I grew up, like it wasn't really the same. Like there was art history, but it was always quite pompous and sort of made me switch off because it made me feel like I didn't know enough about it. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, I must have failed somehow. I must have missed something. So I'm just not going to, you know. But I was trying to remember my first memory of seeing art. And it was when I was remembering, I must have been christened when I was about 5. And the vicar was coming round to our house. And my dad took these 4 photos off the wall that were kind of Mapplethorpe-esque, sort of like orchids and legs apart and stuff. And he took them off the wall because the vicar was coming round to talk about my christening.
Love that.
Oh, that's great. That's so good.
That was amazing. You had that on the wall, though, and you grew up with them influences in your family home.
Yeah, so it was like, because my dad was a fashion photographer, so there was photography around, but it wasn't actually Mapplethorpe. It was kind of like an 80s take on, you know what I mean? It was a bit more fashion photography-esque,
But was you around, so when did you first realise that there was gay art, and also especially photography and fashion photography, it was predominantly like gay men that were spearheading a lot of that movement. When did you know that that was a thing? Can you remember?
I didn't at all. I think like the first time that all that stuff, especially things that alluded to imagery like Mapplethorpe, I just thought was orchids. You know what I mean? I didn't see the kind of innuendo and all of that.
Sexualized,
But I think the first time, Jesus, I was thinking about this. I was sort of like seeing Tom of Finland stuff, you know? And that was kind of quite sexually aggressive.
But you went straight to Tom of Finland.
I remember being really shocked by Tom of Finland for some reason. Like, I just found it so kind of overtly sexual, and I think I just wasn't ready yet or something.
Why did we see it as kids, though? Because I definitely saw it in and around school.
Yeah, no, I think I did too. Age.
What?
And I wonder what that's about.
Yeah. I don't know when the first gay imagery... I mean, I remember when I was a kid and we went to Tenerife and you could get them playing cards in like the kind of local shops that had all naked women on or naked men, and you can get them biro pens. You click it and they're like bra and knickers that come off, or their pants.
The clothes fall off. And I love them.
The clothes fall off and you tip them upside down. And I remember I bought a pack of cards and I must have been 9 and I was shaking like a leaf, and I think they were like 3 pesetas or something. And I took these cards and I remember I went back and I sat in the toilet and I just stared at these cards just thinking, oh my God, I had to hide them. And they were like, it was like they were fire in my hand, but I was able to stare at these images and these photographs from, they were porn. They were like soft porn imagery. But when it comes to art, I don't know when I first saw artwork that was depicting homosexuality or anything LGBTQI plus that I was like aware of it. But do you remember, Adam?
Gosh, no. I was trying to think.
It's hard. I can't really. Because I think now we know, but now it's like trying to think when the first thing.
The first thing.
It must have been Hockney. Like you're saying right about the two men in the shower or the guy in the pool or
I remember,
two boys cling together.
Yeah, I remember finding a Hockney book in the school library. And one of the reasons I was looking at it was weirdly linked to Madonna again, because he did this photo collage made of loads of different Polaroids where he had like a naked woman in a bed or something. And it really reminded me of kind of like erotica, that whole era. And I remember seeing that that was the first image I saw. And then the more I went through it, I discovered all his etchings, which were like of him and his then boyfriend in the 70s, I guess, 60s maybe. And I remember just like Christopher being like, what? Like, this is, you know, what I'm feeling almost like. And they were very tender, kind of intimate, you know, like maybe them in the bathroom or like him looking in the mirror, you know, or in bed. Yeah, but you always had the sense of them hugging or kissing or...
It was quite sexually inert, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, the pool and the pool picture. So the pool pictures is a sort of whole series of pictures. And I think the ones that are the most famous are actually were in LA, in his house in LA. But they first started in France, in this place just outside Saint-Tropez, in this little place called La Garde-Fenêtre. It's a place called Le Nid du Duc, which was a house that belonged to Tony Richardson and Vanessa Redgrave, and they had a pool there. And what was so crazy was, and Hockney visited, and I went there many, many, many years later with a bunch of friends, to stay for, I went two holidays there, and the pool is the one that he did the first painting of, the first pool painting in that. And the thing is, my friend Julia took a picture of the with the same angle and two of us doing, you know, one of us inside the pool and one of us on the side. And it's so, she sent us like that next to the actual, a postcard of the actual painting. And it's so funny, just the trees were much, much smaller in his version. But it's so amazing to think, you're in that, you've been swimming in that pool that this kind of great series of, I mean, it's really iconic and sort of, I think also the thing, like, not just the gay thing, but just the fact that it's just two people in a pool, that can be fascinating and can be a lot going on. It can tell you a lot about their lives and the whole, I mean, it's, yes, the nuance of just a simple interaction, I think kind of came out of those pictures and of Hockney in general, I think.
Yeah, and I'm just fascinated by the way he just had the confidence to say, I'm going to paint my life. And I don't care about it being judged in any way at that time, I think was so transgressive. He's so fascinating for that reason.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And Francis Bacon as well. It's like the way that they worked together, like the way that they reacted to each other. And I think at one point, Hockney saw a Bacon show, maybe in 1960 in Marlborough Gallery. And I think you remember he said to him, you can smell the balls. He felt he was so kind of visceral, the imagery, that for Hockney, he was so like completely blown away by what Bacon was doing. And it felt like that period, there were so many, when it was still illegal, so many outwardly like powerful queer voices in the visual arts that were creating this work at a time when it was still completely legal. And I find that so empowering. And now we have so many queer artists, but it felt like then it was so much more vital, you know, it felt like that was really kicking back.
Yeah, there was the Hockney stuff was, there was something very polite about his images though, wasn't there? There was something that felt like it would, and I feel like that's why it became so huge, because it sort of subtly got a message in without offending anyone.
And collectors wanted to live with it. It was comfortable to live with. It wasn't too overt. It wasn't too aggressive or sexualized. It was, again, it was the nuance. So a collector could say to, you know, their parents who were like, what's that about? And it's like, oh, two friends on holiday. You know what I mean? It's like, you can forgive them. But other works that were so, you know, you look at Warhol, when he did all the ones that kind of keep kind of coming, resurfacing, all the blowjob drawings and the dick pictures and stuff. And they were like, for himself, he created these.
I did the foreword for this book, this Andy Warhol book called Andy Warhol's Men. And it was actually what I wrote in the foreword was, I had no idea he was such a good, so good at drawing. Because actually he's got these sort of Cocteau-like one-line sketches that are so good. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but I didn't realise he was so proficient in all that stuff. I thought it was more kind of in the more, you know, poppy...
screen printing,
graphic design sort of, yes. But in that book, there's some amazing pictures of penises and things like that. And also some photographs as well. It's called Andy Warhol's Men, currently available on alancumming.com/shop.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
I just
come back from the Tate, seeing the Warhol. Yeah, go on. Sorry, what was that?
Oh, what was it like?
It's great. It's great. But there's the room that I was really inspired by was the Ladies and Gentlemen series, where he took Polaroids and drew, at the time they called them transvestites, but transgender community and the drag community. And they found them all from separate bars, and friends recommended friends. And he did this whole series. And so many of these, and they're people of color, so many of these are kind of lost in history. We don't know who these characters are, but yet there's Marsha P. Johnson in there. And there's other really? Kind of oh, wow. trailblazing activists. But it's such an incredible body of work that is a time capsule of that moment that I spent so long in there just studying these images, and you want to know more because these hidden, these voices, and now we're knowing more about, you know, Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera and the Stonewall movement. We're getting more of that information come through now than ever. But these, and especially because of the trans community and people of color, it's like the forgotten history. Anything where there's fragments of the past like that, I'm completely drawn to and want to suck it up and know yes. more.
I remember going to Maureen Paley yes. Gallery in London about 10 years ago, and that was the first time I ever heard about like Peter Hujar. And then at the time, Anthony and the Johnsons was you know, putting Peter Hujar's photographs on their album
yeah,
sleeves.
Candy Darling. And I remember,
yeah, Candy Darling, yeah. exactly. And then also learning about David Brunarovich, like that whole generation yes. of artists. And then also the photography of Mapplethorpe. And I don't know, like yeah. I sort of caught up much, much later. And it is, I like that word of time capsule because it really is, isn't it? And the whole AIDS
yeah.
Pandemic and, you know, it's
and how many
some incredible
were wiped, how many were wiped out, again, photography-wise, how many trailblazers there were who were queer in the photography like sector, not sector, but in photography world, for want of another word, who, again, a whole community was just taken away with AIDS.
what they were doing, what they were pushing, how they were pushing ahead. Look at
Lena Dunham's mum, like Laurie Simmons. Like, what's the name of the artist that she looks after the estate?
He's called Jimmy DeSanza.
Yeah, Jimmy
DeSanza. They called him Uncle Jimmy, and he was this queer. He photographed these really kind of random, kind of space agey imagery of like a very like fragmented body parts in like kind of space age costume. He died of AIDS, and Lena's got this whole story about how, you know, when Jimmy comes over, if Uncle Jimmy starts bleeding or cuts himself, you can't go near him. And Uncle Jimmy isn't very well today. So, and you just think, bloody hell, what that must have been like, and how many of these queer artists were just taken away before they had the power to fulfill their potential.
Alan, do you remember when we spoke to Frank Holliday, an artist in New York? Do you guys know him? He is a abstract artist, and he worked in Warhol's factory, his first job.
Wow.
And now, is, you know, he's still around today, but we spoke to him about exactly that, you know, living through the AIDS crisis and all his friends dying and what that was like, and, you know, extraordinary time. And
he was that was that hilarious story. Shall we tell that hilarious story?
Please do.
So, because we're talking about the way that, you know, it's interesting, there's this TV series I'm trying to get off the ground actually about this time in the late, sort of mid to late 90s, when the cocktail drugs kicked in, that meant that, you know, people could live with HIV. And there's this show I'm working on, it's called Overtime, because all these people who thought they were going to die suddenly had overtime. They suddenly had life, and most of them had maxed out their credit cards, given away all their possessions, and now they're like, oops, you know, I'm alive. And also like all the survivor's guilt and all these things. So it was around that time. So this guy, Frank, had never been tested, but he knew he had it. And when his health got to the point that he couldn't, you know, look after himself anymore, he went back home to, was it Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or somewhere like that? Maybe it's Pittsburgh.
Begins with P, anyway, but north of New York.
Anyway, so he went to the thing, and he was in this room, and he was, you know, he was sick, and he was going to get tested. He had been tested. He was waiting for the doctors to come back, and he was in there for hours. And it was the night of the Tonys, and the Tonys were on telly in the room, and they kept saying, you know, blah blah, coming up later, all these people, and also a special performance by Liza Minnelli. And he was just looking forward to seeing Liza. And so, so it came to the point. It was at the commercial break. And right as the commercial break ended, and they said beforehand, you know, Liza's coming up, the music was starting, and said, now, two doctors came into his room in hazmat suits, right? Completely covered in hazmat suits.
Oh my God.
And he was like, he obviously knew what was going to happen and why they were in hazmat suits and what the result of his test was. And he just went, could you just hold on a second? I want to watch Liza. And so he watched the Liza number, and then he turned to them and he said, yes, you're HIV positive. I think that's just the best thing ever.
Oh my God.
Can we get your priorities? That's your priority, isn't it?
He's like, Liza.
Totally.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But also, Liza, just give me this. Will you just give me 3 minutes of Liza before you give me a death sentence?
Before you give me, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's kind of, I find it is... completely mixed in the narrative of our gay history when it comes to art, when it comes to creative people, when it's quite hard to separate it of that period of time now, isn't it, of these artists and the AIDS epidemic, because they're so entwined and so much of the work was born out of that. Do you feel like that's like, now we're in this pandemic now, that work will be so entwined in this period that we won't be able to separate it? I know like people are dying, of course, but it isn't like this is a massive thing. But do you think, like, can you see the work sort of being the same?
Well, I think in a way, more, what I think is interesting about with AIDS, it mostly hit the gay community and there was a lot of artists in that community. I think per capita in this pandemic, there's probably not so many artists dying. But what I think is fascinating about the legacy of AIDS is the schism between the generations of gay men. And like, I did a movie a couple of years ago called After Louis, when I was, of course, the older gay man. And there was a young guy that I was having an affair with. And we were talking about the idea that there's this missing generation of mentors and everything. And that to me is really interesting. What is missing? What is missing because of AIDS? And also what will be missing because of COVID? I mean, for a certain generation, it'll be a year of their education. and a year of, you know, maybe, I think it must be weird, like, you're, if it's your first year of college and you've got to stop all that and go back and live home with your mum and dad, it must be this really weird sort of sets of problems that we're going to find out more about in years to come, that how people have been affected by just the logistics of what we're all going through.
Mm. There was also like a sort of heartbreaking private struggle with HIV that we haven't had as much with COVID, you know, that these people were being left to be ravaged by HIV because they were deemed to be broken people anyway, who deserved this disease. And I think that with art is an incredible mix. And I think that's why it's such a potent time, because this community of people who all just had each other because they were excluded were then ravaged by AIDS was just so unbelievable to hear people talk about. You know, when we spoke to Frank Holiday, for example, it was just the most bitter ending to something. Yeah.
I also think there was such an intimacy to the work that they were making, a lot of these artists at that time, because they were making it in their bedroom. So if you think of Jimmy Desana, like, they were all like just shot in small interior spaces, and the same with Peter Hujar, you know. And I think there's something about that thing as well. You know, I remembered the other day about when the leaflets used to come through in the mid-80s onto the doorstep in England, and they had that really heavy advertising campaign about AIDS, and they'd kind of like...
Oh, with the iceberg.
Yeah, and I watched it the other day online, and it is such a terrifying advert. And it talks about how, like, AIDS is coming for everyone, and that up to that point, it had just been small groups or something. Like, the way they termed, you know, the terms used is so homophobic.
But that was what I got.
Really?
I was like 17 in 1982. And I think these things started in, I think those commercials started maybe 84, 83, around about then perhaps. But I was like, I was, you know, just starting my sexual odyssey. And we had the fear of fucking God put into us by those commercials. Yeah. I mean, actually, I'd look back on that. I think that's the one thing, a good thing I think Thatcher ever did, because it was under her watch and those ads went out and they terrified everyone, and everyone used a condom.
Right.
Well, not everyone, of course.
Yeah, so they were actually successful.
It really was effective.
Yeah.
If you want to scare people to make sure they use a condom, you know, that was a successful example of it. And it was John Hurt did the voiceover.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
The idea of this iceberg, which has got AIDS written in it, but it's an iceberg. So it's only the tip of the iceberg that we're seeing now. There's so much more going on. I mean, that kind of metaphor was terrifying. And I think it really certainly changed my life, I think, in terms of, because, you know, I was at early stages of being sexually active, and all my friends, both straight and gay, everybody was incredibly vigilant and very chastising of each other if you had, you know, oops, little accident. Everyone was on you about it. It was just completely across the board.
There's an education thing, I think, which is interesting, isn't it? Because there was heavy education about the dangers of queerness, but no education about what it was to be queer. And I think it's interesting how back then, if we're thinking about all the touchstones of art that we've just mentioned, like, most of those people are white and men. And it's the white gay experience, isn't it, that we are. And I feel like now we're going back, like you were saying, Russell, like going back and seeing that Marsha P. Johnson was in those Warhol pictures, but it was just ignored. And to reappraise all of that is a really exciting time. I think that feels like the future, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we had Margate Pride here last weekend in Margate, and two of the speeches, you know, were talking all about Marsha P. Johnson, and it's so brilliant that, you know, people are now acknowledging her kind of legacy and the fight that she was fighting for all of us. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, she, you know, thanks to her.
I've got her on my t-shirt today, this very day. I've got Marsha P. Johnson on my t-shirt.
Have you?
Yeah, drawn,
no
drawn
way.
By my husband, actually. For it says, sometimes you gotta throw a brick. Gotta throw bricks. World Pride, New York, 2019. Grant drew this picture of her for these t-shirts. Funny old world.
So is your husband an artist?
Yeah, he's an illustrator. So he,
Oh my God, cool.
He's, it's funny because tonight I'm going back into the city to, I've got to work on this thing tomorrow in a studio, and I'm going to actually my bar, Club Cumming, to do some intros because we're doing this virtual variety show. And the Grant drew the murals in Club Cumming. There's these two murals that everyone loves, and they're really beautiful. And he and everyone gets a photo taken in front of them. And he did them. And now we've got these masks with the mural. I'm going to wear it for the first time tonight. The Club Cumming mural masks.
When did he do the murals? Because I was in your club last beginning of the year. I went there with Grant. He didn't point them out. How long have they been there?
Oh, did he not point them out? Oh no. Well, they've been there since the beginning. They're like, as you come in, if it was busy, you mightn't have seen them.
Oh yeah, it was really busy.
Because you basically, as you come in, they're on either side. But if there's people in front, you won't see them. Uh-huh. It's more up, there's a sort of little raised bit. We call that the VIP area, yeah. Laughingly. That's where there's a couple of chairs. There's one there. And then there's one like on the same side as the bar, but further towards the door. There's two sets. Right. They're really gorgeous.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's an incredible space, and I saw this amazing.
Yeah, he's a darn.
Didn't Liza Minnelli demand that she was added to it?
Yes, Liza demanded. It was so funny because I was in LA and I was visiting Liza and I was telling her about the bar and everything and, you know, what the spirit of it I wanted to get and all the kind of bring people together, all ages, all genders, all sexualities, all that. And I said that Grant was drawing a mural and stuff, and we're chatting with her, and she went, I want to be in the mural. I was like, what? And she went, I've got the same spirit as Club Cumming. I'm like that. Tell Grant I will kill him if he doesn't put me in the mural. And so I went home. I was like, Liza said she's going to kill you if you don't paint her in the mural. So that's why she's in it. There's a picture of her. I'm giving her a kiss in the mural. Yeah. Hey, boys. Do you know this Scottish artist called Alison Watt?
No.
No.
Ah. I think she's great. It's funny because, you know, when we were going to come on this podcast, I was trying to think about sort of seminal artist or art moments for me or about art, pieces of art that spoke to me. And I always remember the very first time I made any money from acting, like my first job. And I had like this, you know, however much it was. And I remember I was in Glasgow and I went to this big sort of, what's it called? Princess Square, this kind of big gallery of shops and everything. And there was this beautiful painting by Alison Watt. And she was, before she was famous. And she's this Scottish painter that does these incredible sort of, she's done lots of different things over the years, you know, but I think she's stunning. And this was a painting of hers. And I wasn't drawn to it because I knew her name. I knew nothing about it. I just had a connection to it. I loved it. And then there was also in the next shop along a pair of Catherine Hamnett jeans that I was just obsessed with as well. And the jeans won. And I bought the jeans instead of this little picture by Alison Watt, which was a foolish decision on many levels. Because also, like, you know, the jeans, the pockets broke within a week and I would always lose money by putting them in. And it was that sort of ripped jeans, start of that ripped jeans phase. But I just always regret not buying that Alison Watt.
So what was the image? Because I can see that she makes works that are like close-ups of fabric or something.
Oh, that's one sort of wavy thing. So you're looking at the wavy things. That's one phase. No, it wasn't one of those. It was earlier than that. She said, you know...
Is she queer?
This was like in the 80s. No, I don't think so. She was just... I don't know. She's just... It was just something very beautiful and simple about it.
She's an OBE as well.
Yeah, I really loved her.
She does portraits as well. They're nice.
Yeah, the portraits really are nice. Great.
Very yeah, I think there's somebody in the Scottish National Portrait Gallery, actually.
Lucian Freud.
That she did a portrait of somebody that's really stunning. I can't remember. Oh, that's another thing. I got my picture. Do you know an artist called Christian Hook? He won the Portrait Artist of the Year Award a couple of years ago. And the prize was you got a picture in the Scottish National Portrait Gallery. And I was the subject.
Oh.
And so he did this incredible picture of me, which is in my nation's portrait gallery with all, you know, the great and the good of Scotland. And there's me with a kilt around my neck and looking crazy. But I really love his
work.
Oh my God,
I'm looking at it now. It's amazing.
Isn't that stunning?
What's his name again?
You're very glamorous.
Christian Hook. And what's funny is that there was two, the one that's in the gallery, I've got the kilt around my neck and I'm sort of looking over my shoulder. And there was another one, because the when it was unveiled, it was like there was still part of the TV program, like Joan Bakewell and Frank Skinner were there and all that, you know, and I unveiled the thing and it was terrifying, actually, sort of in the grand hall of the portrait gallery. And hilariously, they took down the portrait of the Queen to put my one up in its place. Thank you. Drop the mic, snap. but he'd done... Yeah, insert Queen jokes. He had done another portrait of me and he gave me the other one. And I think it's on Google as well. It's the one with the sort of three different versions of my head or something. And you see my nipple. And
oh yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Oh my God, these are great as well. And he painted Sir Ian McKellen as well.
He did Ian too, yes. He's done a lot of people. And he's done, I think he's got some sort of TV show now where he goes around and paints people and things. But he's from Malta and he's just amazing and such a nice guy. And I've been painted a few times and you sort of imagine when you're going to be painted that it's sort of like a quiet, calm thing. You'll sit there and just sort of, just with your thoughts. And sometimes it is, but this was like, chat. He made me paint a couple of times and just talking and everything. And he put two amazing things into the picture, the one that's in the gallery. I told him that he said, how are you? And I sort of said, I'm actually kind of sad. My dog I had for a long time had died recently. And also Scotland had just voted no in the independence referendum. I was very sad about both those things. So in the picture, there's first of all, the kilt that I'm wearing is the kilt of the independence campaign, the official tartan of the independence campaign. And my dog was called Honey. And there's a little jar sitting next to me that says Honey on it.
Aww.
And then it says yes, yes, yes around the brim. And so my little mutt, you know, from the pound is in this, going to be forever in this portrait in the Scottish National Portrait Gallery. But I love that he took things about from my life and talked to me. And at one point I danced. I just danced. He'd seen me dancing. He'd come to my dressing room when I was having a party. And he said, I want you to dance and I'll paint when you dance. And so he was like flinging paint onto the canvas and I was dancing around. It was such fun.
How long does it take to be painted?
Oh, well, that one didn't take... Well, we did a couple of sittings. He did all these test ones. I've actually got a few of his test, you know, paintings he did of me, sort of in greys and blacks that I really like. But it was over a couple of days. We did a few sittings and some photographs. But then I did... The most recent time I did that was, you know, Don Bicardi. He's Christopher Isherwood. Who wrote the Goodbye to Berlin and all the stuff that Cabaret is based on. His boyfriend, Chris Fisher, was dead now, but Don Bicardi is a painter and he's still alive and he lives in Santa Monica. And a couple of years ago, I was making a film and he invited me down to paint me. And it was one of those mesmerized, and he's a very old man and he's sort of that weird, you know how, have you seen the documentary about them? It's really great. It's called Chris and Don, A Love Story or something. And
no, I never saw that. I know his painting.
Oh, it's so good. Because, Don Bicardi was very, very, very young when they started going out. And he basically kind of subsumed his life into... He became, you know, he started to sound like him. He talks like this. He's sort of got, you know, he's a California boy, born and bred, but he's got this amazing accent. And Michelle Williams, who was playing Sally Bowles, she told me that she'd said to... She sort of talked to him about stuff. And she said to Don, do you miss Chris? And he said, well, how would I miss him? I've become him. Isn't that spooky? And so I was in his studio being painted by him.
Mr. Ripley.
That's enough.
And I was in his studio, which was the room that Christopher Isherwood had died in. And Don did these amazing pictures and drawings of Christopher Isherwood whilst he was still dead. Well, whilst he was dead and still in the room before they took him away. And I'm sitting there being painted by Don Bicardi. And over Don's head is this massive portrait of Christopher Isherwood that's looking down at me. And I think, God, here, this man who never knew me affected my life so hugely by, you know, because I did a play that was based on his works. And here I am all these years later in the room he died in being painted by his surviving partner. And that was an incredible experience because I was about 4 hours and it felt like it was 10 minutes. And we didn't speak at all. It was really incredible.
Wow.
And I tried, yeah. And he wanted me to look in his eyes the entire time. It was like, you know, in Jungle Book, trust in me. It's like that.
Thank you everyone for listening to that episode. We are very happy to have collaborated with Homo Sapiens. So get over to Homo Sapiens now. This is just a reminder and listen to their episode of Talk Art.
Part 2 over at Homo Sapiens.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances?
Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.